This is Mae Brussel, and it's side two of World Watchers. In case you missed the first half, some people pick it up just in the middle or one third through the broadcast. It's program number 739, and I'm talking about the shuttle that blew up this week and what I think were the causes of it blowing up and who was behind forcing it to go up, even though there were orders don't go with the icicles on, and the spaceship did go up with the icicles. And it blew up in less than 2 minutes. It was gone. San Francisco Chronicle has an article with an interview with William Dillon. He was one of the teachers that was chosen as a finalist who wanted to go up in the spaceship. And he said, "I was shocked that they launched Tuesday, to be quite honest with you." Wearing his white blazer emblazoned with a NASA insignia, surrounded with models of the Challenger, Dillon said, "It was common sense that if it's below freezing and the rocket temperatures are far in excess of 1,000 degrees, it's just not a good mix." Another story in the San Jose Mercury, Wednesday the 29th, the day after the explosion, has a long story, but then there's a section, "Weather factor discounted. Suggestions that the unseasonably cold weather at Cape Canaveral might have played a role in the accident were discounted by the NASA officials." Who asked, an NASA official, who asked not to be identified. He's saying this is all hogwash, of course, but I'm not going to put my name to it because later, if it turns out to be ice, I'll look like a fool. He doesn't want to be identified, but he says that's not it at all. Liquid hydrogen and oxygen are far colder than winter air, and all the tanks and plumbing equipment that they come into contact with are sufficient to separate these and to keep them from blowing up, I suppose. He said liquid hydrogen must be kept at minus 423 degrees Fahrenheit and liquid oxygen at minus 297. But that has nothing to do with the fact that Rockwell said don't fly when it's cold. And they didn't have photographs of the other side, but the seams were torn, and that's where this fuel went in and caused the fire. He wouldn't be named, but he said it's not a problem. It's discounted. They referred in this article to San Jose Mercury article to the explosion of the German ship, the Hindenburg, that landed in New Jersey May 6, 1937. I don't know how many of you remember that. I was very young, but I remember that fairly young, 15. And in Los Angeles, over near the Farmers Market on 3rd Street near Fairfax, there's a Pan Pacific Auditorium, and there was a big field that's owned by CBS now. And the dirigible, the one that used to fly over Los Angeles, had its base there, and it took people up for rides around the city. And the day after the Hindenburg blew up, my father took me over. We were out somewhere, or maybe he did it specifically, but he took me over to where the dirigible was, and he said, "I'm going to take you for a ride in that." I guess he didn't want me to be afraid of things such as the Hindenburg blowing up. Or maybe wanting to get rid of me with, I don't know what he did it for, because he's not like that. He wasn't like that at all. And there were just my father, myself, and a few passengers. And he took me up in this big blimp to show me that the dirigibles are safe. But I haven't been one of them, and I never hope I'm not going in the space shuttle either. Some newspaper stories were beginning to play down the icicle story. One large quotation from the Los Angeles Times in big letters said, "It is unlikely that any piece of ice smaller than an office desk could have caused significant damage to the casing." But that isn't true. Cold weather was a warning. Cold weather was a threat. Ice was a threat. Rockwell said it was a threat. So they begin to slow it down and make excuses. And the truth is that it is a problem. January 31st, the San Francisco Chronicle has a article and in there, there's a quotation, "The accident occurred so fast and with no warning on the instruments watched by the ground controllers. NASA engineers are looking for exceedingly subtle hints of trouble that may lie in recordings of temperature." So temperature is a factor, and the initial speculation was that icicles formed on the main fuel tank as moisture from the air condensed during the 10 hours of below freezing weather that preceded and delayed the launching the first time, and one or more of the icicles might have jarred loose during the flight and punctured a hole in the rocket motor. And this is exactly what they're coming up with, the ruptured fuel tank. In the morning paper, as I say this morning, NASA experts believe ruptured caused the blast. The rupture in the fuel tank called Fool, fuel tank the apparent rupture in the strong rocket casing, and they said there was had the effect of pointing a torch at the side of the Challenger's fuel tank. Now, the last thing I am is a scientist, a physicist, and I'm not very good at math or a lot of the details that go into figuring these things or physics or into hydrogen and so forth, but I know how to read a newspaper and how to listen to things that are said on the media to hear what they're saying, so that it didn't take more than, say, 3 hours after this thing went up that I was able to figure this out. Now, there was no evidence of sabotage. There's a long article in the San Jose Mercury, January 31st, on all the problems this Challenger has had and how their first mission in January 83 was postponed and another one in August 83, December 82, and it runs down problems July 12th, 85, problems with the engine, problems with this particular machine. But the interesting thing is that they said the vehicle's third mission in August 83 came within seconds of a disaster when the lining of the nozzle on one of the two solid fuel boosters almost burned through. But August 83 was the time of the Korean airline, and this was the space shuttle that we had set up, the Challenger, that was flying over simultaneously when the Korean airline left Anchorage, Alaska, and was blown up inside the Soviet Union, that was doing spying for the United States government and testing the alert systems of the Soviet Union that brought down Larry McDonald. This is the same spaceship Challenger. So I guess the karma came back, and this time the Challenger went down, and that was the spaceship that was, as I say, simultaneously. Now, the Korean airline was 007 was supposed to leave and go to Seoul in South Korea, and Jesse Helms and 35 members of a congressional committee went ahead of Larry McDonald. He went alone, Larry McDonald, president of John Birch Society of Western Goals, with the pilot of the president of South Korea, and they were going to do this big spy mission and were knocked out of the sky. But their plane was synchronized for when the shuttle would be over there, and they were testing and photographing other parts. This was a war machine shuttle straight through. Incidentally, they compared the searching of the material here for pieces of the airplane, which in fact, if parts were found, would show what kind of a spy machine it is. I have no doubt about that. And the Los Angeles Times has a story, it had one January 30th, just this last week. The search for clues in the debris promises to be a difficult task. Government investigators agreed this search may prove at least partially similar to the investigation after the 1983 shooting of the Korean airline flight 007 over the Sea of Japan in the crash of Air India, which later they brought the parts up in the black box and showed that had been bombed. In the KAL incident, the United States spent more than $22 million searching for the wreckage and the flight recorder around 3,000 square miles of water, looking for pieces of the airplane. $22 million looking for pieces of the Korean airline so that the Japanese or the South Koreans or the Russians wouldn't be holding in their hands the absolute proof of the spy information, although they had it on tapes. This was the physical evidence, and our government just throws his money away. No wonder we have such a tremendous debt. So this was the same Challenger that went up in August 83, went down this time, and again was going down on it was a great spy plane, and Reagan was using his teacher. Now, Reagan was very saddened, of course, by this effect, this machine going down, and he wanted civilians in space. This was his idea. There's a story in the San Jose Mercury, January the 30th, 1986. According to Mr. Schmidt, Senator Harrison Schmidt, C-H-M-I-T-T, and other sources, President Reagan was anxious to open space to civilians and personally announced his Teacher in Space program at a Washington Awards ceremony August 27, 1984, honoring secondary schools. Before Reagan's decision to choose the first citizen passenger in the history of our space program, a teacher, NASA intended to send a journalist first, and I think it's going to be Mr. Cronkite that goes up there as the journalist. The Reagan decision occurred amid his political campaign in which his foe, Walter Mondale, wanted to rally teachers against the president. The president had cut federal aid to education by 25%. So, according to Schmidt, NASA and the White House realized it would be politically wise and logically to work with the educational community first, since children are the future and a great deal of the momentum behind the space program. They would be the ones pushing it. So he decided to have the future in the hands of the children and pulled the announcement just at the time of running against Walter Mondale, the 27th, the end of August, and the election was in November, that I'll put a teacher, so you teachers vote for me, and then the teachers could push the space program with the students and get them all interested, similar to Hitler's youth. Now, the speech the president was to give last Tuesday night, according to the LA Times, would be very brief. The State of the Union would be very brief, and he was having a fight with his staff members on what to include and what not to include, but it was going to be a thing about American family, strengthening the American family. And I'm sure that Krista's husband would be the one sitting next to Nancy, beaming, the husband, the wife, and the little children, and she was going to humanize space and show how great that was. Another story in the Wall Street Journal, Hero Hour is near, and Reagan won't talk about it until tonight. An exemplar for the nation would be hard to locate. Last year, there were some, and it mentions people that he's had next to Nancy when he announced a Hero of the Week, the heroism, the Hero of the Year. And as I say, it was a top secret. He wouldn't say who it would be, but I bet his face really fell. And he had to take the momentum because there are so many things going wrong in this country at this time. We can't even list them in 10 hours. And look to the future. And the future is the space. The future is Star Wars. That's the number one thing on the agenda, on their schedule. And here was his teacher that he promised. And Reagan identifies with John Kennedy. John Kennedy said, I'll have a man on the moon. And it was there. Reagan said, I'll have a teacher. And this blast off couldn't be delayed. It was delayed 1 day, 2 days, 3 days. And then the ice came. And somebody, as I say, in Washington had to say, go, take a chance. Because they were willing to take the chance to send it up, even though the icicles were the same. The speech was written, and that old goat can't rewrite a speech that fast. You know, if the ship were on the ground, the space shuttle, and he's giving a speech, you know, to say that it will take off, it wouldn't be so dramatic to have Krista's husband, Mr. McAuliffe, sitting next to Nancy. It would be much more romantic and dramatic, and there's nothing else to say, so he was going to go to the future and reach up to the firmament and hold everybody in their spell. San Francisco Examiner had a story. Reagan's not likely to address the depressing reality of the country, and it goes into the problems and so forth. President's challenge to Congress that he's going to lower the domestic spending way down. It has to go $200 billion. The deficit is $200 billion, and it has to be lowered, and he doesn't want to touch his military. And today, Caspar Weinberger was asking for a 100% increase in the Star Wars budget. So Ronald Reagan was particularly involved in this teacher and the synchronizing of the space being up in the air while he's giving his upper speech. January 29th, LA Times story said, Krista McAuliffe's fate seemed especially distressing to Reagan, who had surprised the space industry and the political world during his 1984 campaign by announcing that he had directed NASA to search for a teacher to become the first citizen astronaut. Now, who was the teacher, and what is Ronald Reagan's love affair with teachers? Other than being political, you have to go back to his early ideas about education. For you long World Watcher listeners, approximately 282 broadcasts ago, 5 years ago, broadcast number 456, I was talking about Ronald Reagan's running for governor and how it paralleled Claude Kirk of Florida. In the 1966 elections, he and Kirk got together. Kirk was the first Republican in Florida in 94 years. He was engaged to a German woman living in Brazil. Reagan was running against Pat Brown in California. So from Florida to California, they were running a campaign to break the back of the University of California. And immediately after the inauguration, Reagan fired Mr. Kerr, the president of the University of California. They met for lunch January the 13th, 1967, and Reagan met Claude Kirk in Los Angeles. As soon as The elections were over. They were inaugurated. Then Kirk flew to L.A., where their financiers and manipulators were, and met with each other. And the very next day, January the 14th, Clark Kerr, K-E-R-R, one is Claude Kirk, the head of Wackenhut Corporation, who does the security for the space stations and for the military. Clark Kerr, the former president of the University of California, he was fired. He was told no pay, no notice, and he was dumped. His goal when he was president of the University of California was a college education for every person in California. And I asked the question going back, way, way back, a long time ago, about Ronald Reagan saying that fascism does away with the educated, that we're going into a fascist state, that they need a handful of experts, scientists, computer programmers, and management, and a lot of slaves, that education stirs too much trouble. Education should be for the rich. You should skim off the minority and the poor white. If you want to look into the Los Angeles Times or New York Times story, The Curiously Divided Life of Clark Kerr, this was October the 9th, 1973, and I mentioned it on that broadcast, 456, that Kerr was a major force behind the 1959 California Master Plan for Higher Education, which assured every high school graduate in the state an opportunity to obtain higher education, also assigned various educational tasks to different segments of the academic research, and trained all the PhDs while the state colleges would concentrate on undergraduate work. In 1966, the gubernatorial campaign of Ronald Reagan criticized Mr. Kerr for being too lenient on the students there and the protesters and so forth, and he met with the Board of Regents, and this tells how he went ahead and fired Mr. Kerr. And starting January 67, the Regents met. Kerr refused to resign. He was fired by a 14-8 vote. And then conservatives who long opposed Kerr were joined by Governor Ronald Reagan, including his strong allies. One was H. Robert Haldeman, later in jail because of Watergate offenses, and Alan Grant, president of the State Board of Agriculture. Another article from that era, Kerr warns of college plights in 1974. A long while later, he was saying that the country would take away support for higher education and it would be a matter of mere survival. People would be living from one day to the next, and that's exactly what Ronald Reagan did. Going back to an earlier article I have in Nation magazine by Fred Cook, the wonderful writer, Governor Kirk's Private Eyes, and this is about Claude Kirk's working with the Wackenhut Corporation, the CIA, the FBI, with George Smathers of Florida. He was best man at Kennedy's wedding and introduced Nixon to Bebe Rebozo to make those connections, and it tells about the Wackenhut growing as a security for NASA, for the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, for the Atomic Energy Commission, and other federal enclaves that pour millions of dollars into Wackenhut. And Claude Kirk formed that and worked with Ronald Reagan in breaking our educational system. If you want another early article, New York Times, January the 8th, 1967, Florida's governor set up private police force, and this has to do with his intelligence operations in the United States. Two big policemen, Ronald Reagan and Claude Kirk. So the idea that he wanted a teacher in space was a political gambit. It was an excuse or a ploy to hide exactly what the space shuttle is. And it is for Star Wars, for land-launching space stations, for future genocide like Alternative 3. And this teacher went with it all the way. The Los Angeles Times had a story about the plans. Well, maybe you saw it in many of your papers. What the plans for, as I say, 600 teachers were to attend the launching. They did, and 4,000 students from around the country were to watch the launching. Now, they had 600 teachers out there at the Space Center in Florida in that freezing weather, 4,000 students, and they couldn't delay it for the fourth or fifth day. They were all waiting there, and as I say, the orders went up. Rockwell said, don't fly with his ice. They knew that by Sunday that if it was cold on Monday, they'd have trouble on Tuesday. And it was getting colder, and the snow, the ice was coming in. And they were told it was a hazard, but they had the children there. And this one article, and you've seen many of them, from her orbiting classroom, she will teach two lessons that students in hundreds of schools will watch from Public Broadcasting Service, and she will make a demonstration film to distribution schools. The space agency wanted to get her up there. They were anxious to get her up there so that she would help raise money and promote the package of the school system, encouraging children to look to the future, to look where they can't see or get, and forget what's on the ground, how their cars eventually will fall into holes in the road. The Los Angeles Times had a story before the blast off January 27th. Shuttle fever grips nation schools. Westwood Elementary School science teacher is scrambling to find a satellite dish to install on the playground so the students can monitor the journey of Krista McAuliffe, the first teacher in space. Students in Mitchell Elementary School are luckier. Video satellite communicate donated an antenna dish to watch the shuttle. The antennas will give the students the ability to watch the broadcast from the space shuttle throughout the day. Educators believe the historic flights to begin today are a valuable opportunity to bring first-hand experience of scientific research into the classroom. To help promote teacher in space classroom activities, the Los Angeles County Office of Education mailed to local schools 3,000 copies of a curricula package developed by NASA so teachers could integrate the mission's activities into their lessons plans. One of the lessons is where we've been, where we're going, and why, to help students understand what is going on. Another story, the news media invades Concord, going to the students and checking out their grief and involving these students in this particular operation, which Ronald Reagan wanted. Now, as for Krista McAuliffe, it is so disgusting, the promo that's been given about this poor woman wanting to go in space. There was a long interview about her, another one from the LA Times. They did a particularly good job. She said her husband wanted recorded for posterity that she take along her prized possession, his class ring from Virginia Military Institute, not his wedding ring, nothing like that, but she took along for history the ring that he had at a military school. She said she wanted to teach history of ordinary people, and this is what smacks of fascism, of Adolf Hitler. Forget Wall Street, who was funding him. Forget where the money comes from. Reach the masses, the children and the babies. She wanted an ordinary view of history. She's a history teacher. She wanted to teach them to get interested in space law and space business and prepare for the future, the new frontier. She linked her trip into space to the journey of a pioneer woman in Conestoga's wagon and how she planned to teach her experience to televise classes from space. Now, this Conestoga wagon cost $20 billion. The space program has put $20 billion into this. And forget this, an isolated incident of a woman with her military ring of her husband going up there to tell the poor schnooks around the country that they shouldn't look down at their feet because they don't have shoes to wear, and don't look at the roof because it's leaking, and don't look at the hotel you're living in because there's no housing. But she was going to promote for the agencies the money and the enthusiasm, and knowing that it's a military operation, she said that she's not interested in the large things of history, that she was the first ordinary citizen to be chosen, just a school teacher, and she'd go down in history as an ordinary person. This wasn't an ordinary trip, and I get so tired of this BS, and that's all it is. It's a hunk of BS. You know, that one little trip to launch it is $50 million. To replace it is $2.2 billion, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. My great-grandparents came around the Isthmus of Panama from France or England, and nobody paid for their buggy or their ship. She's no great pioneer. Before she went off, there was a gift of a $1 million insurance policy for her and her kids. And she wrote up in her resume how she wanted to go out and explain to people and give lectures and have conferences. And her goal, when she was asked what she would do, she, as an educator, she would go on this exciting prospect with national, regional, and state educational conferences. She would disseminate information. She was a propagandist for people to get hunks of money with no noticeable reward before planet Earth is fixed up. They're telling us that we got digital watches from space, and I heard a whole program on what we got. So we have digital watches. There was nothing wrong with the old-fashioned watches. We could tell time by them, even use the sun. For goodness sakes, it's so ridiculous. She would go. Over 4,000 educators, she said, attended a seminar at the National Social Studies Conference in Washington. She would attend these. She would go to annual conferences. She would meet large audience lectures, small personal workshops. She'd make videotapes and lecture on this. They asked her what she would do. How would you share your experience? Well, there was a lot of fringes to go on to this. This wasn't a thing that she would lose anything on. You'd lose your life, but she took the risk, because if you came down, it was big bucks from then on, doing everything she wanted to do. Mr. Borman of the space program became president of Western Airlines, or Eastern Airlines, rather, and he's going broke now. He couldn't manage it. It's not the same as what he was educated to do. And Senator Glenn, he was from the space program, but all of them got books, movies, lectures, and a lot of fringe benefits that go on and on. And somebody, as I say, just handed her a $1 million insurance policy. This isn't a pioneer. The pioneers that came across this country in their little covered wagons, nobody bought their horses for them or the blankets that covered them. This was a major operation. Just last night, I was reaching for a certain book on my shelf and pulled out the one called Hitler's Youth. And it's called The Duped Generation. And there's a picture of the young blonde boys with the drums on the cover. It was published by Ballantine Books under the section of politics, book number 6, that series. And the young boy there reminded me of the young youth in space that was interviewed on Larry King's program, for all the world looking exactly like those Hitler youth. And on the back of the book, it says, boys and girls were thrown together by crises. This is what happened to unite the spirit of these people, by fear and belief in their country. And that's what Ronald Reagan sells to us so well, belief in your country. But with nostalgic view that must appear came the memories of victims and the innocent and the appalling misuse made of the youth's idealism and the spirit of self-sacrifice. Worthy of a better cause than that which the Führer offered the youth of his Germany, his youth. The appalling misuse of their idealism. Not to get them to make a bridge from this city to that city. Not to work on rapid transit like they're putting in Europe, or subways all over the world that we don't have. San Francisco has, Los Angeles doesn't have. Pollution, getting rid of the spoils with Environmental Protection Agency is running out of money. The sky is polluted. The water is filthy. The fish have chemicals and mercury. Earthquakes happen and no one can rebuild, you know, these appalling catastrophes that happen. And then the masses are pushed aside and the multinational take over. The idealism and the spirit of the president pushing this at this time, it's his fifth year in office. He was going to give a speech. The deficit is something he promised the balance of budget to take care of. The deficit is horrendous. 5 years after his speech promising all this and getting elected for those things, the balancing the budget, it's worse than ever. He thought, I'll drop the taxes and raise the cost of the military and the foreign aid and the Contras and the Angola freedom fighters and the Afghanistan freedom fighters. And America is identical to what Herbert Hoover was doing, where all the money was getting ready for the next world war, and this is what Ronald Reagan is doing. So he has to look to the future, and the future is in the space where they will beat, or hope to beat, the anti-Russian, anti-communist mentality, and they have to get the children swayed. If it went up, it was a success. That would be his speech, and that was going to be part of the speech. And if it goes down, we've made these sacrifices, so in their name we have to go up again. And that's the way he does it. Now, the crew was a military crew. Francis Scobie, the commander, was Air Force mechanic, entered the flight school, worked in the Air Force, has been an astronaut with the shuttle planning the next stages of Star Wars. Michael Smith, longtime military Navy commander, got his degree at Navy Postgraduate School out here in Monterey. Ronald McNair, degree in physics, MIT, and so forth, Ford Foundation Fellowship, worked with NATO, all military. Gregory Jarvis, captain in the Air Force, he maintained the rank of captain. He was an engineer at Hughes, working on this kind of activity, spaceship and tests for the fuel tanks for the Challenger. And Mr. Onizuka, same thing, laser specialist. Judith Resnick, from Carnegie Mellon, electrical engineering, with NASA, worked for Xerox, all military people. It was a military crew except for the teacher. And behind the petticoat of a woman teacher with a husband and children at home, the perfect American family, teaching from space, normalizing space, that's what she was supposed to be doing, traveling with 6 military people who are testing weapons, setting and preparing for World War III, taking her husband's military ring, not his teddy bear, but his military ring. That was the significant thing. She wasn't anything but a military woman. He's a lawyer, went to a military school, and goodness knows, maybe an attorney for one of the agencies. No doubt he was, and she was selected to be the spokeswoman. Give us your money, give us your savings, give us your debts. Let's get on up there. That's the future. America's being bankrupt, and the president had to give the speech that night. Somebody in Washington said, go ahead, the icicles are still there. Take the chance, because he's not going to get a speech like that in another year, and the budget problems are coming up now, and he wants the budget for the space and the Star Wars, and they took the risk. The risk didn't work. They found the seams that broke. The icicles could break the seams. The ship went up. They'll get money to make another one to go down, because the American people are suckers, and they'll give it to him. This is Mae Brussel, and I'll be back with you next week with some more disgusting news. Sorry about that, but it is pretty bad.